Packet Pushers.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Packet Protector, where we explore everything at the intersection of networking and security. I'm JJ, and today, Drew and I are going to dig into some new cybersecurity rules or proposed rules that will probably impact most of us, even though the title of those rules is the Cyber Incident Reporting for Critical Infrastructure Act of 2022, which is pronounced as its abbreviation, CIRCIA, C-I-R-C-I-A. So Drew, we've been researching and reading a very long document for the past few days, but before we get into that, let's look at a few of the news headlines, because we have a couple of things that I think also might be impacting many of you guys listening we want to tell you about.
Absolutely. And the first one is a critical SSH backdoor in popular Linux distros. I think probably many of you listening are using Linux. This is the, and you may have heard of this already, the XZutils, if I'm saying that right. It's basically a compression utility, very popular, very widely used. And somebody was very quietly building a backdoor into it.
Yeah. And so for those of you that use Linux yourselves on your desktops, the way this got snuck in, it just happened in the past few days. So most of these are builds. Some of them go back into February. So I would say if you have updated anything since February and you're using Debian, Kali, Arch, any of Fedora versions, definitely check this out. Also Alpine, maybe lesser used, but it is listed in many of the repositories as not being impacted. But I have heard from people that downloaded it last Friday and it did have the impacted version of this library in it. So I would just kind of check everything if you're using anything that has any of the SSH built into it, even if you're not using it. This is something you need to check out.
Yeah, and I guess what the attacker did was able to build a backdoor into this because they started actually contributing to the XZutils project. And I've heard other sources say they were actually making like useful contributions. And so they were like, great, almost nobody is helping us with this, so we're happy to have you. And then was also building this backdoor. And they're not sure if it was an individual actor or just a profile being used by multiple folks to get this backdoor in.
Yeah. In the InfoSec community, consensus is we believe it is a nation state. It is a coordinated effort for a few different reasons I can dig into if we want to later. But this isn't your grandma's vulnerability, because this was a multi-year attack. And what they think is that a threat actor and entity or group, you know, spun up this account on GitHub, you know, basically made a persona, came into the open source community via GitHub in 2021, started, you know, doing some stuff and building a little bit of trust, and then also created some other sock puppet accounts. So, you know, fake accounts from other people, and then use those fake accounts to pile on and bolster the argument that the primary developer for this utility needed some additional help, because they were kind of sometimes nicely, sometimes not nicely piling on him with, you're too busy to maintain this.
Right.
And that was kind of crappy, because I think in all of this, you know, that person was struggling with some personal issues and some mental health issues. And, you know, open source stuff, nobody's getting paid for it. Uh-huh. It's a labor of love. It's a lot of time. There's a lot of pressure. So they kind of turned the screws a little bit with that. And they were able to then position this one user, this entity that was kind of helping, into more of a position of trust and actually have privileged access into that, and able to not just make commits, but take over the relationship or the integration between the Google platform that does open source testing, OSS Fuzz, and turn off certain tests. So there are certain places where maybe this would have been seen. And So long story short, the person involved in this attack spent more than 3 years building this persona, building this relationship, and working into the community here. Uh-huh. And then there was one RSA key that would basically backdoor into the SSH. But the end result of that is, if you're running a compromised version, whoever has that key has access into SSH remotely. So remote code execution, they can, you know, do anything you want to do once you get on a machine with that level of access.
Yeah. I don't know if you've seen that XKCD cartoon of this sort of giant edifice of multiple pieces, and it's all kind of held up by one tiny little piece. And if you pull out that piece, the whole thing topples. And that's, you know, what's scary about open source, I mean, what's good about open source and scary about open source is that lots of important things come down to just one or two individual maintainers who, like you said, can face lots of different pressures. They're doing it for free. They may not have a lot of support. And I mean, honestly, tip of the hat for the threat actor for this, because it's a really clever attack, but also kind of frightening, because there's a lot of open source software out there that's all bundled together.
It is. And pieces of software, right? So this is, you know, a compression utility, but it happens to be used in ways that allow an attack on a library that feeds into the SSH modules and daemons. Like, I don't do any code development, so that might make sense to somebody else, but it's not common sense, I think, for most of us to think, oh, okay, there's a compression utility vulnerability, and that is going to lead to or could lead to something like an SSH backdoor. That's just crazy.
Yeah, so we'll have links in the show notes if you need to go look into this to see if you may be affected. But we've got another news story before we get into our main topic. Google has promised to destroy data it collected from millions of users in the US of its Chrome browser. These users were surfing in incognito mode. Turns out Google's actually collecting data about them, despite it being in incognito mode.
Yeah, and maybe I'm like naive Nancy here a little bit. I only use, you know, incognito mode when I'm using an application or something. I'm already logged in and I want it to not know I'm logged in. And, you know, but a lot of other people use it for different purposes. And I think probably most of us, I mean, maybe not those of you that are just super paranoid about everything, but I think most users probably assume, because it's considered private browsing and you think the cookies are blocked, that that type of data scraping basically would not be happening from Google. I don't want to say it was a surprise. I think everybody who has turned, you know, data and browsing into a commodity, they're weaseling and wiggling every which way they can to get that data and monetize it. So I'm not shocked, but I was surprised to read, you know, it sounds like the Google executives knew this was a problem. They knew the wording and the terms and conditions for the software use was unclear. And misleading, not just unclear, but misleading, and basically led the user to believe this information was not being collected.
Right.
You know, it was, which is a little sleazy.
It's very sleazy. When you call something incognito, that's setting an expectation that it's private, when in fact it wasn't. And Google's making the argument that nobody was harmed because they weren't going to tie that data to any, you know, individual user identities and then use it. But it's still, I think, behavior we should expect, but still unsavory.
I say, as I hold my Google Pixel phone in my hand.
That's right. They're listening.
They're always listening.
Yes. Again, links in the show notes if you want to read up on it. But JJ, let's dive into the reason we're here today.
Yeah. I mentioned a second ago, we've got this long title. So basically in 2022, President signed into law something called the Cyber Incident Reporting for Critical Infrastructure Act. And what this was designed to do, when this happens, they basically sign something in and then they voluntell an agency to take ownership of it. Uh-huh. And they put a few very loose guidelines around it or rules around it. And so, you know, some of the guidelines was, okay, they've handed this to CISA to manage. So CISA is tasked with making the rules and the timeline and then managing this program within the confines of this act as it was written 2 years ago. And what's interesting about it is it sounds very niche. It sounds like, oh, okay, this is another, you know, critical infrastructure, something, something protection. And the reality is the language of the draft as it's written now is very broad and impactful and basically puts into scope any company, including and especially any technology company, who sells anything to the federal government and to any of the organizations in scope. So any of the critical infrastructure or organizations that serve national critical functions, as it's called other places.
Right.
And so suddenly we have, you know, not just what you think of as critical infrastructure with like the power company, transportation,
wastewater treatment, chemical plants, that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of other industries in scope here. And the gist of it is that if you suffer a cybersecurity incident, you have to submit a report on that incident to CISA, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, within 72 hours of being reasonably certain that incident occurred. Or if you make a ransomware payment, you have to submit a report 24 hours after making that payment.
And it's a, but wait, there's more. So this, and we'll get to it in a minute, this will impact, because of what's requested in the report, this is going to impact us here, you guys listening, me, and many other people that are typically not impacted through security reporting regulations. So we'll get there and explain that in a second.
So the first thing we should note is CISA has released essentially what is a draft proposal for the rules and requirements that are going to fall under this law. They are opening it up to a public comment period. So if you have a stake in this, you can comment, give them some information, give them feedback, and they will take that under consideration before the final rules are released. So this isn't a rule yet. I think we can anticipate it probably coming into effect in early 2026. But in the meantime, they are going to put it out there, let people chew on it for a bit, get some feedback, and then come back with final rules. So after this podcast is over, if you feel like you maybe have some things to say, there'll be links in the show notes for how you can go leave a comment.
Yep. And I think they're actually aiming for end of federal fiscal year, which would be October 2025 mm-hmm. as the very latest implementation date. And they have already gone through several iterations of, I would call them focus groups, getting people together from the industry, public mm-hmm. and private both, and giving feedback on their proposals. So they've already done a little, this isn't brand new. It's just brand new on the public side.
Right.
And so that was just released today. Before the version that was out today, they had the same content in a different format, like literally different. It was a PDF that was literally just laid out differently, and therefore it was 447 pages.
Yes.
That Drew and I have scrubbed through for all of you listening. You're welcome. We love you. That's how much we love you.
That's right.
The document is now 133 pages, but it's like size 7 font and still doesn't have real page numbers on it. And it is now in a 3-column format, which is absolutely horrid.
Get your reading glasses.
Get your reading glasses. But I am going to say this. If you want to read it, you don't need to read all of those pages.
Right.
Most of the pages are explanations of what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what they've done to this point. It's really, in the current version, it's 133 pages. It's really the last 10 pages that contains the draft proposal for the rules. So 10 pages. If you're interested, you can handle 10 pages.
Yeah, skip to the end.
Just scroll to the bottom.
Yep. But we'll try to give highlights here just to give you something to work with in the meantime. So I think, you know, the first thing we'll start off with is the document refers to organizations or entities that will be compelled to make this report in event of an incident as a covered entity. So the first question is, well, who is a covered entity?
Yeah, and this is where things are a little bit not straightforward.
Right. This is probably the hardest question.
Yeah. If you're used to working in the federal space, I think it's probably a little bit more intuitive to you, and you'll see why in a second. So it does, like we said a second ago, it does kind of cover the typical sectors. But before we get to that, let me go ahead and call this out before people get scared. There are exemptions for small businesses.
Yes.
And small businesses typically, in this particular case, it's small business is defined by the U.S.'s Small Business Administration. It is a varying scale that depends on the NAICS code. And the NAICS code is just your code is a company that's registered with the federal government based on the class of product or service that you provide. So you may have more than one NAICS code, but your NAICS code is going to describe, oh, okay, soybean farming is a NAICS code. Telecom services is a NAICS code. Mm-hmm. But typically, small business is going to be 2 to 47 million, depending on the industry.
You mean in revenue?
Yep, in revenue. Mm-hmm. Or an employee count in the 500 to 1500 people. So if you're under that and you fall into one of these sectors we're about to describe, you're exempt, at least per the draft.
Right. Yeah. So they sort of broke it out. CISA broke it out into different criteria for what makes you a covered entity. They used sector. So things like chemical sector, telecommunications, defense, energy, financial services, and so on. And then size of the business. So if you are a large enterprise, you probably are going to fall under this requirement. If you are a bank, if you are an IT vendor, this reporting requirement is going to fall on you. If you are a small family farm, probably not.
Yeah. So along with the sectors, I would call out to, you know, organizations that own or operate any critical manufacturing. Mm-hmm. There's a long list of things that fall under that. Anything in the regulated financial services realm, so banks, credit unions, et cetera, I don't think there's any surprise there. Things that qualify as SLTT, which in this context is state, local, tribal, and territorial government entities with populations over 50,000. And then similarly, there's some education. So local education, and that's higher ed or like K-12 with 1,000 students or more. Information technology is also critical infrastructure. And there are some specific call-outs in here for anybody that sells, manufactures, or provides services in support of the election process, but also for basically the government or anybody else in these sectors.
Right. Yeah. So if you sell services to the U.S. government, you're definitely covered. But even if you don't, you are very likely to still be covered under this requirement.
Yeah. And then I have a few sub-bullets on the information technology entities. Drew, if we want to cover those, I can run through them real quick.
Yep.
So if you provide or support hardware, software, or services to the federal government, if you make or maintain software that has direct dependencies and can run with elevated privilege or allow any type of privilege onto the network, that is also in scope. OEMs, vendors, and integrators of operational technology, hardware, and software, and any organization that performs functions related to domain name operations, with the exceptions of ICANN and ARIN. Uh-huh. And then what's not in this specific bullet, but is called out in a different place in the document, also specifically mentions cloud service providers that right. the government is using.
Yeah. And managed service providers. Yep. CISA estimates that more than 350,000 entities in the United States are going to be considered covered entities. So this is a substantial ruling that's going to apply to probably most of the people listening to this show.
It is. And it will also apply to a lot of the technology vendors we've heard about in the news recently. So, you know, AT&T just had a breach. That certainly falls into scope here.
Yeah.
Microsoft, specifically knowing that the breach was on their government cloud side, I believe would also fall into scope here. So Microsoft just kind of got raked over the coals in a recent like cybersecurity incident review board paper that they've put out. So I think it's going to reach its tentacles into those organizations as well. And it'd be pretty interesting because basically, you know, from a supply chain perspective, this could be really good for the rest of us because we're just kind of forced in some ways to trust, you know, the Googles, the Apples, the Microsofts,
right.
those companies that we don't really have any, you know, it's not like we can go sue them for for doing something with it'll just stomp all over us like an elephant stomping on a mouse. So I think it's going to help in the supply chain perspective.
Yeah, and it seems like one of the reasons they're doing this is because of the danger of supply chain attacks. They want to make sure that information about vulnerabilities or attacks are getting out to the broader public as quickly as possible. And we'll talk about that a little later. But I think it's good now to talk about, okay, so probably you're in scope. If I have a security incident, what kind of incident has to be reported? They take a lot of time sort of trying to describe in as broad a language as possible, but as comprehensive as possible, what an incident actually means, because incident is by itself not very clear. So if you don't mind, I'll just sort of read off the four main points I think they're looking for. First is a substantial loss of confidentiality, integrity, or availability of a covered entity's information systems or network. Second is a serious impact on the safety and resiliency of a covered entity's operational systems and processes. Third is a disruption of a covered entity's ability to engage in business or industrial operations or deliver goods and services. Or fourth, unauthorized access to a covered entity's information systems or network or any non-public information contained therein. So examples they gave, a DDoS attack that renders your service unavailable for an extended period of time, a ransomware attack that encrypts your core business or information systems, persistent access by an unauthorized third party to your information systems, a large-scale data breach or exfiltration, an attack that increases the potential for the release of hazardous materials. That's the kind of scale they're looking at. Has to be, I think, somewhat significant.
Yeah. And I think to kind of just distill that down, you know, for us, it's going to be if you have a cyber incident and you're considered right critical to the nation operating,
yeah.
if you are not able to do what you need to do as a business to meet that demand, think Colonial Pipeline, right?
Right.
That screwed up everybody for weeks across many states. Mm-hmm. So that obviously would fall under this. So something major that impacts your ability to do what you need to do to service the critical infrastructure or the people consuming critical infrastructure in the community and the public, or is a precursor to that in some way that could be disruptive. So that first bullet of substantial loss of confidentiality, integrity, you know, availability, we've already kind of hit on, but somebody gets into your infrastructure in a meaningful way and you figured that out, but they haven't done anything bad yet. That still falls under this because what they could do something
right.
and be disruptive and or steal data, et cetera. You know, what they're not looking for here is any type of impact from a misstep, misconfiguration during a planned requested change. So, you know, those of us that are, you know, that are network engineers or architects, if we make a boo-boo or even as an integrator, right, a third party or a manufacturer doing services, professional services for somebody, you know, if you are under contract and have been requested by the covered entity to do that work, then if something miscarries and whatever just doesn't work as though it should, and that impacts availability in some way, that is not in scope. They're really looking for it because this is not meant to be anything punitive. They're trying to be helpful.
Right.
And so it's really just, did something malicious happen or is something malicious happening or could happen? That's what we're looking for.
Right. Yeah. And did it have like a noticeable effect? I think, you know, for instance, if a virus got through your firewall and hit somebody's desktop, but the desktop software caught it before anything happened, like that doesn't seem like it would be in scope to report. They're not looking for every little thing that goes on.
Well, yeah. And frankly, even if the desktop didn't catch that one and you lost a desktop or two, not a big deal. It's not going to impact your operations.
Yeah.
Same thing. If your website goes down for a little bit because there's some weird, you know, blip in the ethers out there.
Yeah. Or somebody DDoSed you for a half an hour.
Yeah.
That's probably not necessarily reportable. Of course, check with your lawyers first. We are not lawyers, so this isn't legal advice, but
yes,
we're trying to feel out the scope, but.
But I think what's really interesting and is different in this reporting regulation is what they're asking for in the report. And I think this is where, you know, our listeners, you guys listening here, are probably going to have a role to play in this, because a lot of the other reporting is just, you know, file a report, let us know something has happened, especially like the SEC filings, like you update your K-8s, and it's pretty light touch, right? In this draft reporting regulation, CISA is basically going to be a partner through your incident response process. And so what they're looking for is anything and everything you have from a forensics perspective and an incident management perspective related to this. So that could mean packet captures. It could mean log files. If you've malware samples, data from your SIM, communications, if a threat actor is in communication with you, like for ransom payment, all of those communications, text messages, phone calls, all of it. So it's much deeper. They're also asking for, you know, IP addresses, network architecture, diagrams, products in use, versions, you know, hardware and software, including the configurations of those products. So it's, you know, I'm going to say it's more invasive and intimate of an experience doing this report than some of the others that are more just paperwork.
Right.
And this is where I think we're going to come into play, because we might be asked for this information.
Well, hello, listener. You know, getting into the cloud is easy. It's what happens once you're there where things get interesting. On the Day 2 Cloud podcast, hosts Ned Bellavance, that's me, and Kyler Middleton explore the nitty-gritty of cloud operations, from tooling and automation, to resilience and security, to visibility and cost management, and so much more. We talk with technical leaders, practitioners, trainers, and consultants on all aspects of cloud operations to equip you, yes you, with the information you need to address technical and business challenges in the cloud. So whether you're public, private, hybrid, or multi-cloud, let Day 2 Cloud be your guide. Listen at packetpushers.net or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, they are, again, because the idea behind this is to help CISA understand the threat landscape and identify potential attacks that may have other targets and get information out, other potential targets, other infrastructure targets as quickly as possible. So they are looking for a significant amount of information. They also want to know like a description of the incident, an estimated date range of the incident. They want you to describe the vulnerabilities it might have exploited. They want to know tactics, techniques, and procedures that the perpetrators used. They want to know what controls or frameworks you had in place, whether those controls were operating, how they might have failed. And again, as you mentioned, logs, packet captures, even samples or copies of the malware, which is going to be interesting for them to try to hold on to. That's their problem though. And one thing to note about this is because the timeline is pretty tight, once you are reasonably confident that an incident has occurred that is material, you have 72 hours to fill out this report, which is not a lot of time. So they do note that in the report, you are allowed to answer unknown at this time if you do not have all of that information at hand. But that means they do then require you to file a supplemental report at some later date once you do have more information about the incident.
They plan to use AI. Not to be cheeky, but they do plan to use AI analytics. And I think that's a good use of AI to correlate and aggregate this data. Think of it more like a national incident response program, like a national SIM where the vulnerabilities are being tracked, the exploits are being tracked. And as your organization is discovering things and getting more data, they're expecting you to do those supplemental reports as real time as you can and share that with them.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that's probably all going to be, you know, web-based. And, you know, those of us here on this call are probably not going to be the ones having to fill that out, possibly if you don't have, you know, a security-specific compliance person or office or group or department. You know, you might be asked to help with this. But, you know, certainly a lot of the data that needs to be produced and the diagrams and all of that and the architecture is probably going to come from us.
Yeah, you're also allowed to have an authorized third party prepare and submit this report on your behalf. So I assume, the consulting firms will probably move in here, managed security providers and others will probably see an opportunity here to extend their partnership with their clients in this regard. Another thing to note is as you're pulling all this data together for the CISA report, you also are going to have to retain it. Right now, they're saying expect a retention period of perhaps 2 years. That could change over time, but you should anticipate having to hold on to whatever you send to CISA.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I noticed that when they called that out, they specifically said they wanted it preserved in the original format.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah, they went down a rabbit hole with something in one part of the document about that, that if you received a written, like a letter, a ransom note or something or threat, like you need to keep that piece of paper, not some digital format of that.
Do people send written ransom notes for?
I don't know.
Like with the letters cut out from magazines?
Yeah.
I have your database.
You can't do that. But yes, you have to retain everything for 2 years. But like all the digital stuff, you're probably doing that anyway.
So another question is then, okay, well, how do I do this report? It seems like right now CISA is sort of circling around. There'll be a web form that they will produce and manage, and you'll just go and fill it out. They're, I think, considering other options, but it seems like it's going to be essentially a web form. And they'll have a case management system. You'll get a case management number so you can track it and be able to supplement your reports as time goes on and you get more information.
Yeah, one of the interesting things I'm curious, and I think we both read not just the proposed rules, but quite a bit of the discussion and the other part of that document around it. I'm going to go finish that now, not literally now, but this weekend. One of the things I'm interested to understand is, you know, oftentimes when we're in the middle of an incident like this, we might be impacted in a way that we either don't have access to business email or we do have access to it, but it's not safe to use because perhaps the attackers also have access to it.
Right.
And so, you know, especially dealing with federal agencies, they're very, well, a lot of the sectors in scope here often have a pretty thick separation between private and business assets and data. So they don't do BYOD laptops and phones, you know, stuff like that. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how they're validating who people are through this process. Do you know what I mean?
You mean making sure that somebody who's submitting a report is actually that entity?
Yeah. How do you know?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good question. Yeah. I don't know. That's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I certainly, you know, people could introduce incorrect information for a lot of different reasons, right? The same way we're worried about people feeding wrong information into AI, you could get false information fed into the system if there's not some type of validation. So I'm sure they've thought about that. They may not have a solution yet, but I think that will be interesting because if we're saying we can't or don't want to use our normal business email account, and, you know, again, typically organizations fall back into, you know, personal emails, WhatsApp messaging, text messaging, you know, some organizations do have out of band communication mechanisms set up ahead of time. It tends to be for not all employees. It's a subset of employees. So those organizations would have something already in place to deal with this. But, you know, the rest of us, which is probably 99.99 something percent of organizations, don't have that in place.
So I think we talked about this a little bit, but it's good to come back on this. Why is this happening? Well, one reason is it's the law. CISA isn't doing this of their own accord. It was a requirement from that Cyber Incident Reporting for Critical Infrastructure Act, which was a law passed by Congress in 2022. And they essentially then handed it to CISA and said, make this happen. So CISA is making it happen. But they do have, I think, you know, a supportable rationale in that they need to enhance the country's cyber resiliency. So by collecting incident information in a uniform and timely manner, they should have a better visibility into the threat landscape. Then they can share this incident data with other organizations in critical sectors and maybe understand, you know, what mitigations are working against this attacks, what's been effective at limiting the consequences of an incident, and that general data sharing ideally should make other people safer. Do you buy that rationale, JJ?
Yeah, I like the idea of it. I mean, if we think about it, like take it from an engineering and an architecture standpoint. If something were happening in the organization, security or not, outage, security, what doesn't matter, and we were troubleshooting, we would need or want to have access and visibility into, let's just say, the entire data path, right? Is it a problem on an endpoint? Is it over wireless? Is it within the switch route infrastructure? Is it something out on the internet? Is it DNS? Is it DHCP? It's always DNS, but let's pretend it's not for once. To me, this makes sense because it's really just whack-a-mole with critical infrastructure and everybody else. You know, something pops up, somebody deals with it, maybe not immediately. And without aggregating that data together, which is what we do inside of our organizations, right? We use network management and monitoring tools. We use security. We use centralized logging. Mm-hmm. We use SIEM and SOAR applications. And so I think it makes total sense as long as it's executed well. And I think the executed well would be dependent on how easy can the entities get through this form. Right. Because when you're in the middle of a cyber incident, the last thing you need to be doing is taking resources off of incident response.
Right.
And asking them to fill out a form.
Yeah.
Or pass, you know, information around in ways that might not be secure, because this is deep information, right? Your IP addresses, credentials, et cetera.
Yeah. Logs.
You got to set up something ahead of time to share, even if it's outside of the typical, you know, data repositories for the company. There needs to be some place to do this securely. So, I think there's value. I think they're carrying out even the 72-hour requirement came from that original congressional act. Not CISA didn't come up with that. That was from them. So, you know, they're really just executing what they've been told to do. I think there's great value and potential in this. And if they can identify something in 72 hours, right, in that critical window, they can probably help other organizations, or help while it's in progress, or prevent that from happening.
Right.
So I think there's a huge benefit if this gets pulled off well.
So do you think that 72 hours is reasonable, given, as you mentioned, that when you're in the middle of responding to an incident, you're just trying to get it shut down and clean things up? Having to file a report is probably the last thing on your mind.
Yeah, I do think it's reasonable, and I think it's necessary. And I know that's probably not what people want to hear. And it is 72 hours, not 72 business hours, excluding holidays and weekends, right? It's 72 hours, unless that changes later. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what you just need to do in that first 72 hours is get to the point where you understand that there is an incident. Uh-huh. And then at least go, hey, something is happening, and we don't know what yet. Because the other piece is, if you don't have the resources, they can help you directly, right? CISA has resources, or they can pair you with somebody that can help out of that ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So I do think there's value, and I do think the 72 hours is reasonable. Yeah.
Okay. And 24 hours if you pay a ransom. That needs to be mentioned again.
Yeah. I think that's also perfectly reasonable. I mean, by the time you get to paying a ransom, for most organizations, that is not a quick, easy decision to make.
Sure.
And maybe it's made ahead of time through tabletop exercises, mm-hmm. but this has to be made at the executive level. It involves lawyers. It involves risk management teams.
Yeah.
It involves usually law enforcement at that point. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a couple of things is filling out a few fields on a form when you get to that point, you know, and really the only extra information at this point is it's like two other fields about the ransom. But also sometimes the government has ways of reclaiming some of those funds. And the sooner they know, right, mm-hmm. the sooner they can potentially do that and evaluate that. And I think if for an organization, right, the value proposition there being, if you can potentially recoup some of that money, it's definitely worth filling out the form.
Right. Oh, one other thing, I don't know how interesting this will be to people, but I noticed in there that there is a carve out that the information related to a cyber incident that you are submitting to CISA does not necessarily become public information. Like, you can't go request it through Freedom of Information Acts, which in some ways, as sort of an open government person, I'm like, I don't know how I feel about that. But in wanting to get folks to comply as fully as possible, I can see the rationale for saying this doesn't become public information because it does contain sensitive information. So I think they did that to help spur people to actually participate as fully as possible.
I'm a fan of transparency, especially from the government. However, these are private entities also in scope here.
In some cases, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you don't want that information going to the wrong place. So we already have instances of, especially China, you know, scraping even some academic articles from here. Like, I think it was Duke University published something years ago on some interesting, like, facial recognition. It wasn't just facial recognition. It was basically how to track specific people through a crowd across large geographies.
Uh-huh.
And China is using that to target certain ethnicities, right, and kill people.
Right.
This type of information at that detailed level of how, you know, IP addresses, how attackers got in, you know, CVEs that were exploited, I don't think that needs to be made public. But what CISA is going to do is anonymize all that data and share it. And I think they're going to share it in a larger form or a more detailed form with the ecosystem that they're going to be building here, public-private partnerships, ISACs, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're also going to be rolling up all of that into an aggregate report quarterly and making that available publicly.
That'll be interesting to see. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting.
Yeah. So a couple more things before we wrap. First, you know, what happens if you don't comply? Because there are often organizations that will try to skirt the issue. If you are covered under these requirements and you don't report an incident, CISA has proposed mechanisms to get that information, including a simple request for information. They'll kind of knock on your door and be like, hey, did something happen? If that doesn't work, they'll go to a subpoena. They can also make a referral to the Attorney General for a civil action to enforce that subpoena. And then if you continue to not satisfy their requirements, they can do things like bar you from being a federal contractor in the future.
Yeah, it was a pretty extensive list. If they feel like you need to give them information, you're going to give it to them. So you might as well just play nice and do it early.
Right. Yes, absolutely. So then what happens next? As we mentioned, this proposal is now in a public comment period, so you can go weigh in if you feel like you've got something to say. And they're hoping to have it finalized by the end of 2025, like fall, September, October 2025. And then they're anticipating it will sort of come into effect early 2026.
Yep. And that feedback period starts today. April 4th is the day we're recording this, and it goes through June 3rd. It's a 60-day window.
Yeah, so if you want to get in there, now's your chance. We'll have that link in the show notes.
Yep, and I'm sure we'll be back here several weeks from now, maybe a few months from now, and we'll you know, kind of give you guys an update when this is finalized.
Yeah, and if you've got insights, if there are things we missed or things maybe you disagree with in our sort of overview here, we'd love to hear from you. You can hit us up at packetpushers.net/FU. The FU stands for follow-up. We're always happy to get comments, clarifications, corrections, or just whatever's on your mind.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us for another episode of Packet Protector. Remember that you can find and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want more nerdy goodness on networking, wireless, cloud, go to packetpushers.net and you'll find thousands of hours of free technical content for your listening pleasure.